Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Yuyun Zhan, host of our monthly podcast Zhonghua Mundus that brings you recent updates about China's economy. As usual, I'm with our co-host, our senior fellow, Alicia Garcia Herrero. Hi, Alicia. How are you?
Hello. How are you doing?
Good to see you, Alicia. Also with us today is Bertin Martens, also a Bruegel senior fellow who specializes in digital economy. Hi, Bertin. Good to have you with us today.
Hi, Yuyun. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. And finally, we're welcoming back Paul Triolo, partner and head of technology, Asia and Americas of DGA Albright Stonebridge Group. He already joined us for a previous podcast episode on U.S.-China tech competition. But as the race is evolving constantly, we're glad to have him back again for stock take on current global AI economy and discuss Europe's policy options in the midst of U.S.-China strategic competition. Hi, Paul. Welcome back.
Great to be back. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me today. Bertin, you and Alicia have just published two Bruegel analyses on the global AI race. In the pieces, you argue it's really a battle over the AI stack. Can you explain what that means and why it matters?
Yes, the AI stack is a sort of vertical stack of different layers of technology that you need in order to produce AI services, to deliver AI intelligence. What that stack consists of, if I may copy this from Jensen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA, in his view, it consists of five layers. He starts with the energy layer. You need energy, electricity, basically, in order to transform data into some sort of intelligence. You need the second layer, the hardware layer, that is the data centers and especially the chips that power these data centers in order to transform queries or questions into output tokens, into answers to your questions. The third layer on top of that is the software layer. You need these hardware chips to be able to talk to AI models and bridge the divide between the machine language that is understood by the chips and the machine learning, the network effects, all the data that are clustered together in an AI model. And then on top of that, you need the AI models themselves, the machine learning models that have been derived and trained, pre-trained on enormous amounts of data, and that are able to answer these questions on the basis of what they've learned from the data. And finally, on top of that, you need the AI applications, the specific applications of these AI models that are designed to respond, for instance, to health questions or to engineering questions or to specific transport questions. You have all kinds, you have hundreds of thousands, millions of applications of existing AI models. Altogether, these layers form the ecosystem, and you cannot operate an AI service when one of these layers in the stack is missing. Now, what we see happening today is that most of these layers are in the hands of big US tech companies. You have NVIDIA that has a quasi-monopoly on the most advanced AI chips. You see a number of AI companies from Google, Amazon, and Microsoft to OpenAI and Anthropic that really dominate the frontier, the technology frontier of AI models. And then you have a host and whole range of companies that are involved in the application layers. It is important to have control over this AI stack and to mobilize this system in order to set it to the purposes that you want to use it for. And Google, for example, uses it to deliver consumer services, but also increasingly services to companies. Others are specialized in, for example, OpenAI and Anthropic are specializing in codecs, in AI systems for software developers, for people who write computer code. And And so they specialize in all these things. We get a lot of competition in the upper layers with many providers, but there is less competition in the lower layers, especially in the chips and hardware layer. And that is where the US has a step ahead over China. But China is coming up very fast as well. It's starting to accelerate the build out of computer AI computing infrastructure. It's starting to produce very good models, AI models that can compete with the best US-based AI models. So all this creates a lot of tension between the US and China for control over these AI stacks. Europe is sandwiched somewhere in the middle. It has a bit, but not very much, of AI computing infrastructure. It doesn't produce its own AI chips. It's dependent on US providers for that. And it produces only very few AI models that can compete in the top of the range. So Europe needs to build out that stack. And the question is, how can it do that? And that's what our papers focus on.
Thank you very much for the introduction. It gives a really clear overview of the topic that we're discussing today. And we're also, of course, going to put the link of the papers that you mentioned. So for listeners who are interested, can read on it for more details. So Alicia, let me come back to you. Bertin mentioned that China is also another big power when it comes to the AI stack. So how close is China actually getting to the US in AI capacity?
I would say that, you know, if you look at just all of the existing race indices, China's been 3 to 6 months. And the question is whether that has changed a lot with the Mythos Sam Fable and whether Jipu, which is this supposedly similar model from China's side in terms of, you know, cyber kind of capabilities, is really at that level, because that would maybe reduce further the distance. But beyond where China is, I think this is only part of the stack. Yeah, I mean, Bertin said the stack is the 5-layer stack. And it's not only about how advanced models might be. It's also about compute. There, I think the US has a big, big lead. But it's also about electricity. And that's where China has the biggest lead with critical raw materials, which you could argue is, you know, the upstream part of the stack. So it's like China dominates the upstream part, electricity, the inputs, if you want, to all of this. And the US dominates compute. That, for me, that's kind of the clear difference between the two. I think the other thing I like to say is that for compute, this brings me to Bertin, you know, that the key point is, of course, access to these advanced GPUs from NVIDIA. But even there, I mean, China has been trying very hard to minimize that distance with Huawei's Ascend. But not only that, it's also about how China has done it. I think this is the key lesson for Europe. So what China decided to do is to still push the US for the best GPUs, and with some hesitance, because, you know, pride is also important. So saying, yes, maybe we don't need them anymore. This was Xi Jinping at some point saying we don't need to import them. But having said that, I think what really matters here is that China was playing double game. Industry, so developing its own GPUs and at the same time importing the best, so as to train its models more efficiently. And so, you know, I think for Europe, this is important. If we think about our sovereignty, we cannot just go and substitute it all. I think we would need to think of do step-by-step industry. We need to decide how we do that, how costly that might be, but also, of course, import the most advanced models and push the US to do that.
You already mentioned that Europe is somewhere in the middle, and then it's really we're still in this US-China tech rivalry. Paul, from a Washington perspective, does that assessment look right to you?
Yes, I think it's gotten quite complicated. I think, you know, Washington right now is in a bit of a funk, arguably, over the whole issue of, for example, frontier models and how to release the most advanced models. And so, you know, prior to this issue of what to do about releasing models like Mythos, which really occurred earlier this year in the February timeframe, the administration in Washington had focused largely on promoting innovation in AI and diffusion of AI and the pushing the US AI stack globally. This was the focus for quite a bit of time.
less focused on things like AI governance. How do you put some guardrails around these models, which had been a big focus of the Biden administration, and particularly late in the Biden administration, which had initiated a series of international conferences, for example, designed to figure out a minimally viable global AI governance framework. And so we saw, of course, a lot of, in the U.S., this huge amount of investment over the last year in AI infrastructure buildouts, alliances between companies like Anthropic and OpenAI and Meta and Google and other leaders in the U.S. to try to build out compute capacity. And also, of course, to continue some of the export controls on China that has slowed China's own development of more robust infrastructure. At one level, I think there were these two races, if you will, between the U.S. and China. One is sort of this issue of diffusion, who is using and adopting AI models and applications more broadly, that top layer of the cake that Bertie mentioned. And there, of course, Chinese open source models, for example, have been very important and been used and have been, you know, the uptake of those models has been, but at the same time, there has been a sense of racing towards something more advanced, artificial general intelligence, artificial superintelligence. And that's a sort of a secondary race. But this was all brought into significant focus with the release of Mythos, which had this very strong capability, for example, to discover cyber vulnerabilities in all software. And when this was released, of course, and when this was shown to the government told Anthropic, basically, you can't release this without some level of government approval. But because there is no legal framework for dealing with the release of these frontier AI models with advanced capabilities, we've seen over the last month, in particular, month and a half, 2 months, a lot of churn in Washington about this issue. And this has come at a time, of course, when the U.S. and China also agreed to set up a more serious dialogue on AI and frontier governance coming out of the May summit between the two countries. So we're sort of in a weird situation now where the U.S. government still hasn't figured out, for example, what exactly the conditions will be under which leading AI labs in the U.S., and then eventually this is going to have to be something that happens more broadly in Europe and in China, you know, under what conditions should companies be allowed to release these models with clear national security kinds of implications around things like cybersecurity and also things like biosecurity. And so just in the last 2 weeks, we saw, for example, Anthropic release Fable, which was supposed to be a version of its leading model, Mythos, that had made it difficult for users to take advantage of those cybersecurity capabilities. But Anthropic was ordered, interestingly, using U.S. export control law in a sort of novel way, to basically say Anthropic had to pull access at that model globally, particularly to non-U.S. persons. And while the U.S. government sort of figured out how to, you know, under what conditions it would be allowed to release this model. So this is where we are right now. Just this last week, the Commerce Department and the U.S. government, who were negotiating this with Anthropic very detailed set of negotiations, now seems to have established a process by which Anthropic can share Mythos and its very advanced capabilities with other companies and other governments, including likely in Europe, which is already, there are some companies in Europe that have already been approved to use this. But Anthropic was doing this on its own, and now the U.S. government is going to insist on some level of approval over who gets access to this model. And this is important because one of the reasons the U.S. government likely forced Anthropic to pull access to this model was because Anthropic had tried to expand the list of companies that would have access to this model. And one of them was Korea Telecom, which apparently some of the U.S. government believed ties to China. And so this is now, the release of these models has now become a huge political issue in the U.S. because if it's really, as I said, for the first time, sort of focused minds on the idea that these models, and not just the models, but the way they're orchestrated, the kinds of things they can do together and multi-agentic versions of these models, for example, that are put together to do a certain task, can have very serious national security implications. And so for Europe, of course, it's a big issue, because European companies and governments will want to have access to some of this, the most advanced U.S. models, if only just initially to help protect their networks from cyber-related activity. And so we're sort of in a stage where, you know, I think both the U.S. and China and the EU are all now quite aware of the capabilities of these models and have to figure out a way to govern release of the models. And I know that it also comes at a time when US and China, probably this month or early next month, will be discussing bilaterally how to do this. And of course, this comes at the same time as the US is continuing to try to control China's access to advanced compute and other parts of that stack that Bertie mentioned there. So it's a very complicated mix of policy and technology development that the U.S. government and U.S. companies are grappling with. And then these issues also, of course, have major implications for not just the U.S., but for other key markets, whether it's the EU or other key players in this, which again, China is a big player because it has so many companies that are developing advanced models. So finally, just as the U.S. was determining what to do about Fable, for example, the Chinese firm Jirpu released a very capable model, GLM 5.2, which there's some claim that it has, its benchmarking is comparable to some aspects of Fable. So even though the U.S. has tried to slow China down, obviously Chinese companies are still able to develop very capable models. And then there's concern that because the U.S. is going to control these models and control access to these models, that this will drive up the appeal of Chinese open weight and open source models around the world. And we're already seeing that uptake of those, as I mentioned earlier, of those open source models. And then the current churn in the U.S., the longer it goes on in particular, there's growing concern that this will drive companies and governments looking for sovereign AI deployments, for example, to consider using Chinese models. So we're at a very critical turning point or inflection point potentially in the development of AI as the U.S. government determines how best to manage, control these models. And then other countries and governments will have to also be part of this debate, because again, they'll be affected either because of the capabilities of the models and the need to protect themselves, or they'll determine whether they want to rely on U.S. companies for these most advanced models or whether they'll turn to Chinese models. So a very interesting time to be tackling this issue, to say the least.
Yes, indeed. Many thanks for giving us that detailed description of how things are being viewed from the other side of the Atlantic. Bertin, so in Paul's answer, he mentioned the tech dependence. Also, you mentioned that Europe is using mainly the AI model from the US. So how would this stop of exporting of US most advanced AI model affect Europe?
Yeah, obviously, US export restrictions on advanced AI models to the rest of the world, including to Europe, put us in a very disadvantageous position, especially when these models can be used to affect cybersecurity. And so it weakens our cybersecurity compared to what the US is capable of. And now also with respect to what China is capable of, as Paul mentioned, China recently released its own model that is alleged to have very similar capabilities in terms of cybersecurity offense as well as defense as the most advanced Anthropic models. And we are not in a position yet in Europe to produce our own models because we lack the compute capacity and we lack the companies that can train these models and have access to the data and that have sufficient financial capacity to spend hundreds of millions of dollars or euros on training these models. Now, that's a disadvantage for Europe. On the other hand, I think the fact that there is now competition, effective competition between the US and China making its models widely available, openly available to the world, puts us also in a better position because we could switch over to the Chinese site and get these models, download these models and implement them on our servers to ensure similar cybersecurity capacities. And that would make the US lose market share in Europe, of course. So the US should be very careful about how they are handling these export restrictions. We've already observed, and as Alicia mentioned, China, despite US export restrictions on NVIDIA chips to China, China has managed to almost catch up with the US in many respects in hardware and in AI model building, because they found other ways around these export restrictions, building different types of models, different types of hardware, and creating their own software layers in between that managed to bridge that gap. So China is very close on the heels of the US despite these export restrictions. And the same thing we see now in export restrictions on AI models themselves. For Europe, of course, we should invest as much as we can in building up our compute infrastructure, first of all, and secondly, then developing more of these capable AI models. What we observe today is that frontier AI models remain at the frontier only for very short periods. There are hundreds of other models pushing up from below to reach that frontier, and even less advanced models are today where the frontier models used to be a couple of months or 6 months ago. So for Europe, that's an opportunity to start with simpler and smaller models and still work towards that frontier and develop the same AI capabilities. So it's a double cutting knife, I would say. On the one hand, export restrictions slow us down. On the other hand, like China, they stimulate us to go for more domestic capabilities in Europe and to profit from the competition between US and China to take our advantage of that.
You mentioned that maybe for Europe, we can switch to more Chinese model, but then do we face a similar risk if one day also China decides to stop exporting some models to Europe? Will we have the same problem facing tech dependency here?
Yes, that risk is obviously there. But for the time being, China does not restrict these models. So that gives us some time window to start developing and accelerating our own infrastructure, our own model building capabilities to catch up or to accelerate that at least as fast as we can. So as long as we can profit from both sides, we should do that and put both sides in competition.
Alicia, in your analysis with Bertin, you used the Airbus analog in the paper. Can you explain to us how that analogy works? And then could this be a model for Europe's AI industry as well?
So yeah, so Airbus comes to play because we are aware of the difficulties that Europe is facing in terms of building its own AI stack. And this is what I would call a hard stack. We're very good at the soft stack, meaning governance, regulation, we've done that before anybody else, but we've not done much on the hard stack, on the compute, on the chips, on the models. And I think the idea there is that because it's so difficult and we just don't seem to put enough resources at the EU level to do this. Yeah, we have these AI factories, we have these AI gigafactories, but frankly, the funds are not enough. You can see the difference with the US or even China. So the question then is, could we do what we did with Airbus? Some kind of coordinated specialization by which you should choose not like give every country, you know, whatever quota, but actually choose the best capabilities in the different countries. So you could have IMEC in Belgium, you could have ASML on the hardware or lithography at least. And, you know, you would have to find the best capabilities to do this. And frankly speaking, I wonder whether we would need to stop at Europe or we would need to go beyond, maybe, you know, an alliance with South Korea. South Korea today announced $550 billion in a joint fund with the best memory chip producers of the country. So, you know, the idea is pooling resources and that kind of mimics a little bit what happened with Airbus, which did start very late compared to Boeing and still managed to compete. So being late doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. I think it just means we need to get this comparative advantage point.
Thank you for that. Bertin, did you want to say something?
Yes, on this Airbus model, Alicia and I have received questions from many people on the question to what extent we can compare building an airplane with building AI chips. Building an airplane is obviously very complex, but building AI chips is probably far more complex than that. And when you look at the history of, say, companies like ASML, who make this extreme ultraviolet, very advanced lithography machines that are used to actually make the chips, the silicon chips, you see it's a history of collaboration and between specialized industrial companies. And they had to organize that collaboration. It was not always easy. It was difficult. And many times it could have failed. But it finally worked out. And we see that in chips as well. Companies like TSMC in Taiwan that has the most advanced chip foundries, they actually work with hundreds of subcontractors and collaborators. And they have to create this pool of expertise among many specialists in order to make it work, specialists from all over the world. And so in Europe, we could do that as well. We have a number of important segments in the hardware chain already in Europe. We have ASML, we have IMEC in Belgium, we have a number of other chip producers already. So there's a lot of expertise already in the house. Now, how to coordinate that in order to retain a larger share of the AI value, of the added value in the AI stack in Europe, that is the question I think we should try to address. What sort of coordination, what sort of organizational setup does that require so that Europe does not only invent things that are then exploited and put into commercial use by other companies elsewhere in the world? How can we do more of that at home in Europe?
Just a comment on Bertin's comment about, I think in your question about whether relying on Chinese open weight models creates another type of dependence. I just did a long Substack on this. And I think it's definitely a concern here because Chinese companies, all of course, ByteDance does not open source all of its models. But most of the major labs are currently pursuing an open weight strategy. But that could change. And I think in the next couple of months, we may see the Chinese government taking a more active role in helping to determine what, when, and which types of models would be released in an open source mode. I think this is all being driven, of course, by Mythos and by these claims, which I'm a little bit skeptical of, that came out this week that from some Chinese companies that they've developed models that are somewhat comparable to Mythos in terms of cybersecurity related capabilities. So we're sort of in the middle of a transition here, I think, in China, where the government has taken a hands-off role in terms of open source and open weight strategy. This is not a Chinese government policy. This has been the path pursued by leading Chinese AI companies. But the Chinese government now understands, of course, that these models have potential national security related capabilities. And so it may not want to, just like the US government is concerned about releasing Mythos broadly and having some controls over that, Chinese government may be moving that direction at some point, but they're still, I think, considering how to do that. The fact that the U.S. government, which the other advanced regulatory capacity, has not really figured out how to do this, should be some concern. The Chinese government, you know, does have a fairly robust regulatory system, but this is such a new problem that nobody really knows how this should be regulated. And also to avoid too much regulation that, you know, that stifles innovation. This has been the Chinese government approach, has been to sort of keep hands off here. But we're now in a new ballgame here, I think, just over the last couple of weeks even, in terms of how fast the capabilities of these models are advancing towards these capabilities that the government is going to have a position on. And it's going to have to figure out a regulatory position on.
I agree with Paul that these open weight models are approaching the end of their run of their history for security, for cybersecurity reasons, but also for economic reasons. Training and running these models becomes more and more expensive, and open source is not a good business model. You cannot make much money on that. And so even some Chinese companies have announced that they are considering moving away from open source because, they need to earn a revenue in order to pay for their infrastructure investments. And that's very hard to do with open source.
Yeah, indeed, in this phase, everything is changing very rapidly. Alicia, do you think an independent European AI sector could work? As you mentioned, it's more important to find allies and then to kind of outgrow the market. You mentioned partnering up with India, partnering up with Korea. How do you think this will play out in reality? Does this need some trade negotiations, or what's the direction going forward here?
Well, I mean, if we learn from the Biden administration, they went quite far with India in terms of, you know, AI strategic alliance. We now see India with France, we see Japan, India, France. You know, I think it's really starting. Why? Because what I call the N-2 problem is that everybody is not, we Europeans are suffering from export controls and advanced models from the US. Everybody is. Yeah. So the fact that people wonder, okay, you know, it would be very simple, okay, jump to Chinese models, but we know they might not be open for very long. Then, you know, the question is, we need to pool resources because it's just too expensive to do this, even at the EU level. I mean, imagine if you're a smaller economy. So for me, it does come back to, you know, this idea of coordinated specialization. I realize that, you know, in Europe terms, everything is solved with a free trade agreement. I don't think this is part of that game. I think you could think of strategic alliances in terms of, you know, funding. You could think of, again, pooling compute. I know that that's difficult. I get it. But I think it's even more difficult just not to have anything. Yeah. And I think the key question here is, this is the Airbus story. We Europeans always say, okay, we lost this train, whatever that might be, you know, like advanced models. And this is the Mistral CEO was saying this, not even me, that, you know, not everybody needs the most advanced model. Yeah. And you may need more simple models if you are a public administration or even, you know, for many things a company might need to do. And there, I think, just thinking of basically the amount of imports of digital services Europe will have to engage in to pay for all of this if it doesn't have good enough models. It doesn't have, they don't have to be the best models. I think it's really crazy to abandon that idea. And again, if these are models that need to develop across jurisdictions, you know, beyond Europe, so be it. But I think we need to do it.
Burton, do you want to react to it?
I basically agree to that. The question is, how are we going to react to that? What are we going to do? The Commission came out with its Cloud and AI Development Act proposal a week ago that contained some proposals that try to bring more of that AI infrastructure into Europe by putting so-called sovereignty conditions in public procurement, for example, of AI services. Question is that going to be enough to bring more infrastructure in Europe? European Commission is also subsidizing with taxpayer money some infrastructure built out in the so-called AI gigafactories in Europe. But if you look at the figures, you see the amounts involved are actually very small compared to what is needed. They will not fundamentally change the quantity of AI computing capacity that we have here in Europe. So better instruments will have to be developed that leverage private sector financing, bring in more private capital, and, for example, make American hyperscalers reallocate part of their AI chips quota to Europe rather than installing it in the US, install it in Europe. That could make a real difference in Europe. But we are far yet from a strategy to achieve that.
Thank you for that. Paul, is a more independent European AI sector good or bad for the US?
Yes, I think a Europe that has a robust AI sector is good for the U.S. The U.S. is looking to determine how best to support deployments of the U.S. AI stack globally. So if you see the Middle East in particular, you've seen President Trump, of course, who has great relations with the UAE and the Saudis and Qatar. He's been promoting the uptake of data center development in those countries. And they've become, over the last year, have become key players, I think, and will be, continue to be key players globally in terms of offering data center capacity. So, for example, in the UAE, a Microsoft G42 joint venture is trying to compete in Africa against Huawei offering DeepSeek open weight models on their own infrastructure, their own cloud infrastructure in Africa. And so there's been a big debate in the U.S. about who to allow to have access to semiconductors, such as Blackwell and the follow-on Vera Rubin architecture that from NVIDIA. Who should get access to those hardware? But over the last year, some licenses have been approved, for example, for the UAE, for data centers in the UAE run by U.S. hyperscalers, so particularly Microsoft and AWS, for example. And so those build-outs are occurring even as we speak. And then I think Europe is in the same situation where most European governments, the U.S. would be willing to allow large numbers of these advanced GPUs to be installed in data centers in Europe. This follows the under the Biden administration, the release of this AI diffusion rule, which angered a lot of countries who were relegated to tier two. You may remember that. And so this diffusion rule was an attempt by the U.S. government to control where these data centers are built globally. But the Trump administration basically has rescinded this AI diffusion rule. It hasn't replaced it with anything yet. But in the meantime, licenses are being approved, as I noted, to two specific projects in countries like the UAE and Saudi Arabia. I'll be likely visiting the Middle East soon and visiting some of those facilities there. A lot of this, of course, is still governed by concern about potential Chinese access to those facilities. So there's a lot of complexity in terms of U.S. policy here. But I think in general, the U.S. government would like to see collaboration, more collaboration with European countries in this domain. But of course, that comes with the caveat that, of course, these are going to be cloud deployments by U.S. hyperscalers. And again, getting back to the dependence issue and the dependence on frontier AI models that some companies and governments in Europe may not be eager to deepen. And then there are European alternatives, a very capable open weight model company. So Europe does have some irons in the fire here in terms of particular things like sovereign AI, which I think is going to be a big issue over the next year. As governments try to determine which models they should rely on, U.S. frontier models that the U.S. government is controlling and more controlling, or Chinese open source models, which are capable but not as capable, and other alternatives like Mistral in terms of sovereign AI. So I think in that year that's going to be important. And U.S. policy is evolving here, and probably by the end of the year, sooner, we'll have some clarity on what those conditions will be around the release of those models. And then Europe will probably be in a better position, and European governments and companies to determine the way forward here. But again, yes, I think that the U.S. would love to see Europe be a bigger player here in all across the AI stack. Well, we haven't talked about rare earths yet. I like Burton's the five-layer cake of Jensen Huang. I like to think of it as also sprinkled throughout with rare earths, because rare earths, are part of the AI stack. And you see in the U.S., for example, Pax Silica, this effort by the State Department to try to drive some alliances. I think it's important to note that, for example, semiconductor manufacturing is heavily dependent on rare earths. And so we're in a situation where, for example, the U.S. export controls on China have drawn down China's own export controls on rare earths, and that's impacting already longer-term plans by U.S. companies, for example, in the semiconductor manufacturing supply chain, about how they're going to maintain access to these critical materials that they need to manufacture tooling, for example. And then we've recently just seen the Chinese cut off tungsten exports to Japan. And tungsten hexafluoride, for example, is a critical gas used in semiconductor manufacturing. And two Japanese companies, because of this shortage, have notified TSMC and Samsung and SK Hynix that they've run out or will soon run out of this critical material. So there's lots of interlinkages between the rare earth issue and the AI stack. The last one I'll just mention quickly is photonics. We're moving into an era where things like co-packaged optics are going to bring an optical layer closer to the actual GPU to increase the data rates between from GPU to GPU. And those lasers in those photonic systems, for example, that are produced by Coherent, are heavily reliant on indium phosphide. This is why the Coherent CEO is part of the Trump delegation to Beijing in May, because he's looking to see if he can free up export licenses for indium. So China maintains a lot of leverage points over a whole host of parts of that layer cake, including energy, for example, where transformers and turbine blades are also heavily manufactured in China, and the supply chain is heavily reliant on China for that energy sector in the U.S. So we should just keep that in mind when we talk about these dependencies. It's not just the models, but it's many other parts of the AI stack that have complicated supply chains. We deal with this every day in my work. We're dealing with companies and trying to help them navigate this rare earth issue in particular, which has become so salient recently.
Paul is, of course, right, pointing this out. It's a symptom of our times that rare earth used to be a famous rock band, and today it's a problem in the AI industry. On the other hand, I think we haven't explored many sources of rare earths in other parts of the world yet, because China was such a cheap and proficient supplier of these materials. So I think over the next couple of years, we're going to see a lot of different sources of supply for these materials. But of course, in the meantime, it's very difficult to get access to it.
Thank you very much for joining me in this interesting conversation. I am Yuyun Zhan, and I'm with Alicia Garcia-Herrero and Bertie Martins from Bruegel, and also Paul Triolo of DGA Albright Stonebridge Group. For listeners, you can find all our research on China at Bruegel.org and sign up for Zhonghua Mundus, our monthly China podcast and newsletter with link in the show notes. We are taking a break in August and we will resume our series back in September. So we wish you a pleasant summer break and stay cool and stay hydrated. Until next time, bye-bye.